Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy. I'm pleased to bring to you Sidrat Pinchas, Parshat Pinchas, for OU Shnayim Mikra Echad Targum program. The Sidrat Pinchas begins with a continuation of the events of Baal Peor from the previous Sidra, specifically Pinchas taking matters into his own hands, literally, with a spear, in the rebellion, as part of the rebellion, or in response to the rebellion of the tribe of Shimon in their desire to merge with the Midianites, and essentially to incorporate, to syncretize Baal Peor worship and the Midianite religion into the Mosaic religion. I've said a lot in that one sentence, and it's not appropriate really to rehash the entire previous Sedra, because you've already heard it from the previous lecturer. However, I have to sort of put in my own a little bit opinion about what was going on during the Baal Peor incident in order to make sense of what is going on here with Pinchas himself. The Baal Peor incident, in my opinion, is not an issue of individuals having sex with Midianite women, or even of individuals who wanted to worship in the manner of Baal Peor. One does not have sex in front of the Ohel Moed, publicly in the eyes of Moshe and in front of the whole congregation, and unless one is making a political point. In addition, as we will see, the perpetrators of these events were not just your hoi polloi, were not just average people looking for a good time. They were, in fact, the aristocracy. The man was a leader of one of the ancestral sub-tribes of Shimon. The woman was a princess of Midianite, of Midian, and the leaders of Midian were well aware of what she was doing. Finally, it's probably the most important thing to note when it comes to realizing that this is not just an individual sin, but this is a full-fledged rebellion which put the state of the nation of Israel at risk religiously and, in fact, existentially, is to compare the two censuses, things which usually people don't do because numbers are not the most exciting parts of the Torah. In the first census, that is the Generation 1 census, which is recorded in Chapter 1 of this book, the tribe of Shimon numbers 59,300 people, almost 60,000 souls. After these events, a new census is taken, and the tribe of Shimon only has 22,200 souls. That's 37,000 people lost. It's important to remember that the Torah is not a history book. It's a book of religion, perhaps religious history, but not. It doesn't record historical events just for the sake of historical events. And therefore, when it focuses on the death of a leader of Shimon, it expects us to read that with sophistication. It's not just some guy who wants to have sex with a Midianite woman. But when we put all the facts together, the decimation of the tribe of Shimon, the fact that the Midianites were involved, the fact that these were two leaders of the tribes of Shimon, the fact that these acts were taking place right in front of Moshe to make a point, all of this, when you put together, is the Torah wants us to read it in a sophisticated way and to understand that Baal Peor was a political / religious event which nearly cost the children of Israel their very existence. That is, Israel was sitting on the fences waiting to see who would win, Shimon, the tribe of Shimon, or those who were loyal to Moshe and to Mosaic law. Vayidaber Adonai al Moshe l'emor, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, Heshiv et chamati me'al b'nei Yisrael, b'kano et kinati v'tocham, v'lo chiliti b'nei Yisrael b'kinati. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen, has diverted my anger from the Israelites by acting zealously in place of my zealousness among them. That is, among Israel, and thus I did not destroy Israel. I did not completely wipe them out in my zealousness. B'kinati. This is not the place to have a full lesson on the meaning and the use of the word kinah, zealousness or fanaticism, in Tanakh. Of course, it's famous that it's used by Pinchas as well as by Eliyahu, both are referred to as acting zealously or even fanatically. Eliyahu refers that to himself. And of course, there's the famous Medrash that Pinchas and Eliyahu were the same people, although the Eben Ezra rejects it here, actually, in our Parsha. The word zealousness is also used by a sota, a woman who's sota, where the husband's zealousy and jealousy In fact, his fanaticism regarding his wife, who was possibly unfaithful, and in his zealousness and jealousy, he wants her dead. The idea of kinah in the Torah, in short, seems to indicate extrajudicial behavior. What that means is behavior that's not in the norm of the law, things that don't happen in the courtrooms. One might think of it to a certain degree as a vigilante type of behavior, which is not legal and very dangerous, but necessary from time to time, apparently, to stabilize a toppling political and social system. The rabbis say, in fact, that had Pinchas's victims, had Zimri jumped up and defended himself against Pinchas, he would have been in the right for protecting himself, and he could have killed Pinchas without any legal problems whatsoever. Nonetheless, in these rare circumstances, even though one is acting extra-jurisdictionally, one is acting with zealousness and to a certain degree of fanaticism, only extreme action can save the situation. The Torah here, therefore, is clearly stating that while Pinchas acted extra-jurisdictionally, that he acted with zealousy, this was one of those times that had he not acted, the very existence of the Jews was in doubt. And therefore it joins with the golden calf as well as the people's rejections of Israel during the spies incidents when Israel itself was going to be destroyed by God. And that makes sense because, as I mentioned, we're not just talking about an issue of sex here or even an issue of one-off inappropriate behavior when it comes to religion. We're talking about the Jewish people deciding whether they're going to stick with moral monotheism as defined by Abraham and by Moshe, through Moshe's revelations of God, or whether they would revert back to the same kind of immoral base worship that had dominated until Abraham's finding out what God really was all about, and before Moshe formalized it by hearing the direct word of God. That is, it wouldn't make a difference if they even worshiped a single God, if they worshiped him through the baseness of sexuality and illicit and immoral behavior, then there was no whole raison d'etre of the Jewish people was gone, and therefore God was going to wipe them out since the reason for their existence no longer applied. However, since Pinchas behaved zealously, even fanatically, he essentially, what the pasuk is saying, "Bekanoa kinati," is that he co-opts God's vengeance and therefore minimizes the destruction instead of to the entire Jewish people to a single tribe. It's as if Pinchas pulled the spear out of God's hands, so to speak, and he reduced it from a supernatural spear that could wipe out all of Israel to one in natural scope that wiped out essentially two people and then a half or 60% of a single tribe. And by Pinchas laying about him with his heat rather than God's heat, with his vengeance rather than God's vengeance, he essentially saves the Jewish people. Of course, I don't mean to say that God wasn't in control of the situation. I think what God sees that Pinchas's actions are, and obviously not only Pinchas, but the people who supported Pinchas. Pinchas himself did not kill 20,000 plus of Shimon. What he sees, what God sees, is that in fact the tribe of Levi, as we find out at the end of the Torah in the famous Zot HaBracha, the tribe of Levi themselves joins with Pinchas and is willing to destroy, don't forget, their closest friends. The tribes of Shimon and Levi are brothers. And yet, because the tribe of Levi, led by Pinchas, realizes that the very existence of Israel is at risk, the very existence of their religious identity and therefore of the people are at risk, they are willing to make the ultimate sacrifice in order to maintain Mosaic monotheism. And this averts the tragedy. And as a result, l'chein emor, hineni notein lo et briti shalom. Therefore, God commands Moshe to declare, behold, I guess in this case, either God or really Moshe, I am giving him my pact of peace. Now, it's a strange kind of language, a pact of peace, a covenant of peace. I heard from a student of Rav Soloveitchik that the Rav Soloveitchik said that God was giving Pinchas a pact of peace because he really needed it. He needed to chill out. Rather than making a habit of going off zealously like he does here, he needs to behave in a more calm manner. However, the simple meaning, and once again, it's important to read the Tanakh as populated by real people in real societies who are behaving in real sociological and psychological ways. What God is saying, telling Moshe to declare is as follows. There's no question that once you've wiped out 60% of the tribe of Shimon, the remaining 20,000 of Shimon are probably none too pleased with Pinchas and his followers. In addition, when people act fanatically like Pinchas did, there were probably plenty of other people who were sitting on the fence who were thinking, well, on one hand, we didn't want to worship Baal Peor, but on the other hand, what's with that Pinchas guy? Is he completely nuts? If this is what it's going to be like, we're in big trouble. So what God is doing is he's demanding that Moshe secure Pinchas's position. He's giving him a medal, a stamp of approval, a gushbanka, as it were. And he's saying, lay down the law. Nobody touches Pinchas. I don't care how you feel about him. He did what I was going to do, and you are better off that he did it and not me. And he, as well as his offspring after him, will have an eternal pact of priesthood because he acted zealously for the sake of his God and brought atonement for the Israelites. As I said, all of Israel was going to be destroyed had Pinchas not acted, and that needs to be made known to the Jewish people. There's a famous question here, which is if Aaron's children or family are already Kohanim, then why does God need to turn Pinchas into an eternal Kohen, Pinchas and his children? A Rashi cites the Gemara that says that declaration that Aaron's children, Eleazar, Itamar, were going to be Kohanim would not have included actually Pinchas and his children because Pinchas was already born, and therefore what happens here is God is widening the circle to include everybody from Aaron's line, including people that were born before Aaron's children were declared to be eternal priests. Eben Ezra actually says this was referring to the fact that high priests, that it's specifically Kohuna Gedula, that a Kohen Gadol was always supposed to come from Pinchas' line. And now we wrap up the details on the incident where God tells us just how political and widespread this disaster was, that it was not just an individual problem. V'shem ish Yisrael hamukeh, asher huka et hamidyanit, et is like im, with, Zimri ben Salu, Nesive Dav Lashimoni, and the name of the Israelite man who was struck down with the Midianite, was Zimri, the son of Salu, the chief of one of the ancestral houses of Shimon. V'shem Aisha, Hamukah, Midyanid, Kazbi, Vatsur, Rosh, Umot, Beit Av, Midyanhu. And the name of the Midianite woman who was struck down was Kazbi, the daughter of Tsur, who was a national leader, Tsur was a national leader of the house of Midian. As I said, here we learn that the rebellion had national and political scope. And the Lord commanded Moshe, saying, that phrase, by the way, Vayidaber Lemor, that means a commandment, even though it's only a one-time commandment. It's like an order. Make an enemy of the Midianites, which means attack them essentially, and strike them down because they are your enemies. That is, they attack you in their trickery. That is not directly with swords, but in their trickery that they tricked you regarding the events of Baal Peor and the events of their kinswoman, Achotam, means not directly sister, but it means their kinswoman, Kazbi, the daughter of a leader of Midian, on the day of the plague caused by Baal Peor. Again, it's clear that this setting up of Kazbi was part of a larger plot designed by the Midianites, a plot to overwhelm Israel from the inside using religion and sex rather than war. And if this, of course, if you take a look at Eben Ezra's comments on the prophecies of Bilam, this is exactly what Bilam was saying to Balak and to everybody else. You can't beat them. Ma tovu alecha. You got to beat them from the inside. Or if you can't beat them, make them join you. And that's exactly what was afoot. And God wanted to make sure that the Israelites knew that that was what was going on. This is not just a question of, oh, we all want to be friends. This is a question of trying to undermine the very existence and the very religion of Israel. I should also point out that while the word magifa here, the word magifa in general can mean a supernatural plague like it was in Egypt. However, it's also used to indicate simply losses in war. When it says in the Torah, Vayigofotam lifnei ha'oyev, that means that they fell in numbers before the war. And of course, the two ideas of supernatural losses in plague and natural losses in war are, since those things all happen because of God's will, the two ideas merge together. But the magifah here is not some type of supernatural plagues, boils, frogs, locusts, whatever, that pop up on Israel and destroy 20,000 people and most of the tribe of Shimon. This was a magefa which was brought down by God through the hands of Pinchas with a spear, as well as many other Israelites, specifically the tribe of Levi, fighting on Pinchas's side. Now we go to chapter 26, verse 1, and we have a very interesting pasuk. Vayhi acharei hamagefa. It was after the disaster, after this plague of war. And here, interestingly, the sentence is chopped up. It's broken off right in the middle of a pasuk, right in the middle of a verse, with what's called a ptucha, a wide open space that goes to the end of the line, meaning a full change of subject. That 26, chapter 26, verse 1 is chopped right in half. The pasuk chopped in half. Very rare that this happens. Now, I heard from Rabbi Menachem Leibtag that this was done to indicate that essentially this is the last time that Israel will mess up and suffer magefa. They will suffer losses in the desert, whether be them in war or be them supernatural. From here on in, there's no more life-threatening sins that they commit, and not another Jewish people are lost to war. But there's another reason, really, or I'd like to broaden the reason that Rabbi Leibtag mentioned, to point out that the following section is not in the correct place chronologically in the Torah. It is a case of Ein Mukdam Umuchar B'Torah. We would right now expect to see the war against the Midianites, and Israel, God just commanded, hey, go attack the Midianites. But instead of seeing that attack against the Midianites, we completely change topics. We jump to the census and to other preparations to go into the land of Israel. Now, this, of course, matches with what Rabbi Leibtag said in the following way. As I said before, the Torah is not a history book. It couldn't care less about the Midianite War unless the Midianite War has religious significance. Now, it does, first of all, have religious significance, but we've already discussed the religious significance. We understood that when Moshe wanted to stop this, and the Jewish people almost lost their religion, and Pinchas got up in a fanatical, almost vigilante way and stopped the whole thing, but that's all we really need to know. That movement is vanquished. God wants to tell us to go make war against them, but we don't need to hear about the details of the war to understand the whole Midianite situation, the Baal Peor situation. It's been discussed. Now, the Torah will later get back to the Midianite War for two reasons. There are two religious implications of the Midianite War. First, there is an issue of what to do when you have combat soldiers, active combat soldiers, versus support troops when it comes to spoils of war. How do you divide the spoils of war? And more importantly, the Midianite War had such massive spoils, to paraphrase a former American president, there was essentially a sheep in every pot. There was so much spoils and booty that it caused two tribes, Reuben and Gad, not Menashe's one half a tribe. That's a common mistake. But the two tribes of Reuben and Gad say, hey, we don't want to go to Israel. We got so much property here now from the Midianites and so many sheep and cattle. We want to stay outside of Israel where we can essentially take care of our newfound wealth. But the war qua war, as war itself, is completely unimportant. And therefore, the Torah jumps to a completely different story. That is, the two effects of the war, this issue of how to divide the spoils and the issue of how the spoils affected the two tribes not to want to go into Israel, that all has to do with the fact that the nation is now ready to go into Israel. No more death, no more wandering around the desert. Let's all go into Israel. And therefore, the Midianite War is only important in that regard. When it comes to just making war in the Midianites, we don't care, and therefore we move to a completely different story, one which involves going to Israel, specifically the second census. And the purpose of the second census, the head count, was to establish how the promised land was going to be divided. They were about to enter the promised land. How is it going to be divided? How big are the tribes? How much space do they need? By Yomer Adonai El Moshe El Azar Ben Aaron HaKohen, Su at Rosh Kol Adat Ben Yisrael Miben Esrim Shana Vama'ala, Levei Tavotam Kol Yotei Tzava B'Yisrael, Vedaver Moshe El Azar Kohen Otam, Barvot Moav, Vayarden Yirei Chol Emor, Miben Esrim Shana Vama'ala, Kasher Tzivah Adonai El Moshe Uvnei Yisrael, Hayotzim Me Eretz Mitzrayim. And the Lord said to Moses and Elazar, the son of Aaron, the Kohen, saying, now I think the reason why he's speaking to Elazar, well, first of all, Aaron is dead, of course, but why speak to Elazar in order to do the count? So the answer is Elazar was going to go into Eretz Yisrael. He was responsible to actually match up the count with what would later happen on in Israel, and therefore it's important for Elazar to be involved in this process. In any event, he says, do a head count, a census of the entire Israelite community from 20 years old and up, according to the ancestral families. A Beit Av is like a sub-tribe division. all those who are going to war among the Israelites. And Moshe and Eleazar the priest commanded them, that is Israel, on the Moabite crossing of the Jordan River. That is, again, we're focusing on that because we are one step outside of entering the land, the promised land. They are literally on the banks of the Jordan River, the east bank of the Jordan River in Moabite, or formerly Moabite territory, which was conquered by Sihon, but former Moabite territory, ready one more step, and they're in Eretz Israel. And they need to do this count in order to know how to divide up the land of Israel. All those of 20 years and older, just as the Lord had commanded Moshe and the Israelites who left Egypt, Hayotzim me'eretz Yisrael, that is, just like you did a first census some 39 years ago, and as is recorded in the first chapter of this book of Bimidbar, in order to prepare them to go into the land of Israel, so too are you now going to do it again. Of course, the first generation failed to enter the land of Israel, so the census that they had was made somewhat for naught. This generation, however, will not make the same mistake. They will take a census, they will go into the land of Israel, and they will divide it accordingly.